Good morning. Welcome to the February 16th, 2012 panel event, Electronic Health Records 2.0. What does the future hold? This event is part of the Expert Voices Distinguished Speaker Series and is supported by the firm's cyber campaign. It is my pleasure to introduce Susan Penfield, Senior Vice President at Booz Allen.
Welcome to the Booz Allen Hamilton Expert Voices panel, Electronic Health Records 2.0. What does the future hold? Thank you for joining us. I'm Susan Penfield, Senior Vice President with Booz Allen Hamilton. I'm a leader in the Booz Allen Health business, where I specialize in the management and strategic use of information technology within the national health industry. Today, I anticipate a thought-provoking discussion about the evolution of electronic health records. In recent years, there has been a significant uptick in adoption and implementation of EHRs within healthcare settings across the U.S. For providers and payers, reducing barriers to information flow is one key to improving healthcare quality and reducing costs. For patients, putting health information into digital form creates the promise of greater access, convenience, and mobility in receiving healthcare services. Today's panel will explore the evolution of EHRs, ranging from their early days to what they may look like in the future. Through the discussion, we'll review EHR's evolution, the role of federal government's meaningful use program in incentivizing adoption, as well as some unintended consequences of the program, and what EHRs will look like in the future, and what role, if any, the federal government might play in getting there. I have four distinguished panelists with me today to discuss these issues. All four of our panelists were featured experts in the California Healthcare Foundation's Re-envisioning the Electronic Health Record issue brief, published last week, and we are excited to speak on this topic with them. Let me introduce them briefly. Peter Bosch practices general internal medicine and was an early adopter of electronic health records and e-prescribing. He is the medical director of ambulatory EHR and health IT policy at MedStar Health, a nonprofit health system in the Baltimore-Washington corridor, and provides clinical and strategic leadership for MedStar's ambulatory EHR implementation. Peter is a senior fellow for health IT policy with the Center for American Progress, a visiting scholar with the Engelbert Center for Healthcare Reform of the Brookings Institution, and the board chair of Doctors Helping Doctors to Transform Healthcare. He also works with the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology, known as ONC, on quality measure development. Teddy Tan, a director at Kaiser Permanente within the Permanente Foundation. He has extensive experience in working with large medical groups and technologists to leverage health information technology to ensure that patients and their families have an active role in their own health care. He completed his residency training at Group Health Cooperative and his fellowship training in the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at the University of Washington in 2000. Ted is board certified in family practice. His clinical interests are preventative care and reducing disparities in health status among vulnerable populations. Peter Levin was appointed senior advisor to the Secretary and CTO for the Department of Veterans Affairs in May 2009. His primary role is to lead veteran health and benefits service innovations. He is the executive sponsor of the Blue Button Personal Health Record, the VA's open government initiatives, and several other initiatives as part of the VA's ongoing transformation. Peter is the co-author of more than 50 articles ranging from global positioning and cybersecurity to computer modeling and simulations. He is also a co-author of the technology chapter of the 1997 Biennial Presidential Report to Congress on Science and Technology. And lastly, Gordon Moore is a national leader in improving healthcare and primary care and medical office practices. He is the president of Ideal Medical Practices, where he serves as an advisor, expert, and faculty for initiatives working to achieve better health outcomes at a lower cost. He is also director of clinical transformation for Treo Solutions. He has been a faculty member of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and a clinical associate professor with the University of Rochester Departments of Family Medicine and Community and Preventative Medicine. So a very illustrious panel today. Thank you all, gentlemen, for being here. Let's set the stage here with a discussion about the inception and evolution of EHRs through over the past 30 years. So I'm going to start with Dr. Bosch. As an early adopter of EHRs, could you share your views on how EHRs have developed over the years?
Certainly, and good morning, everyone. And it's a terrific question, Susan, because as we're looking at the future of EHRs, I think it's important to look at what the past held. So it was really not that long ago that of course, we didn't have the term EHR, but the electronic medical record was solely in the province of computer scientists. It was something that people experimented with primarily to track medical outcomes. They were medical databases. So the very first were typically found at universities or people who were interested in the then new field of medical or clinical informatics, and they would input specific outcomes and then track them over time. As computer science advanced and entering text became more than, for those who remember the good old days of word processing, you had to remember all sorts of Alt-Tab, F1 this, enter a keyboard shortcut, and so forth, and hope that something actually happened. We moved toward not just having those computerized databases, but essentially replacing medical documentation as typewritten text. So that was really the history. And that, as you might expect, was very slowly evolving, because how many people would use something like that that took an advanced degree to know how to use, and really was a lot more difficult than writing on paper? Well, in the mid-90s, which is when I started looking at EHRs, there was a dramatic change in U.S. payment policy that presented one of these unintended consequences of, so why do EHRs look like they look like now? And that was a change in payment started by Medicare and then, of course, copied by all private payers, such that all medical care would be paid for if it was documented in a certain way. No longer were people paid for the dysfunctional unit of volume, but the dysfunctional unit of how volume was documented. And this was incredibly difficult to figure out. We, you know, have all these crazy algorithms on blackboards and whiteboards bigger than the back of this room about if you do three of these and two of these, you got it. Oh, you missed that one. Gotcha. And of course, physicians were all told, by the way, you know, no pressure, but if you don't document this way, you won't get paid, you might get fined, and you might be subject to criminal prosecution for billing fraud. These are all scary. Well, EHR developers took what was then not selling and built in coding software to say, we can help you with this problem. No longer will you worry about this. And by the way, if they're looking for volume of documentation, we can build in all sorts of things that makes it easy to spit out lots of documentation. So in fact, we suffer with that now, where EHR documents are very readable, but often they say very little. They're just kind of regurgitating lots of text. So the evolution was essentially fitting a technology to fit the business case of people who were using it. The slow evolution is really, in my view, an extremely rapid evolution of a brand new business case, which is we want to focus on quality. We want to focus on technology used meaningfully to improve quality, improve safety, and lower costs. Aside from closed systems such as Kaiser, where that has always been the case, that is actually pretty new to American medicine. So I would say the new evolution is pretty quick, and I'm excited to see this occur. And for many of us who have been asking for that for many years, and we're told, well, aside from you, there would be no customers for such software, there really is now a big market.
Thank you. Dr. Moore, we're going to turn to you. When you set out on your own as an independent provider, you purchased an EHR to reduce overhead costs and allow you to focus on quality of care. How does your original EHR system differ from today, and what aspects of that EHR would have helped you back then, of today's EHR would have helped you back then?
Yeah, as we heard, the beast of finance has to be fed. And I was in pursuit of quality and patient interaction, and I wanted to facilitate that with the use of an EHR that got workflow right and made it easy for me to focus on patient time. I was really lucky in that in 2001, I was talking to consultants who had looked at a lot of EMRs in the field, and they recommended some good products that got workflow right, that managed all the data. One of the problems in healthcare, aside from the face-to-face interaction we have with patients, is that we are drowning in information, and we have faxes coming in, paper coming in, and we have to deal with all that, plus we have to be able to export data. And so I made a choice to use an electronic health record system that got data management, that got the ability to manage paper, scan it, tag it, put it into patient's chart, and move it around in a pretty facile manner. And that made my life pretty easy. When I actually started working this in practice, I didn't realize that it had a billing system attached to it. I was filling out HICPA 1500s by hand, which was dumb. But then I found out, like, it's just like when you find out that there's a component of a software you use for word processing that does something you've been doing by hand for a long time. Hey, cool. So I started doing electronic billing, and that was way cooler. But it had none of the components of quality tracking, of truly engaging patients, of portals, of sharing facilely the information that patients want to know about themselves, for themselves, to help them do better. So I had to create and use parallel systems. And what I see today is the interest in some vendors and in some settings where that need to facilitate better communication and interaction is being fed, where quality tracking is coming to life and therefore being integrated into more intelligent systems.
Thank you. Peter Levin, I've turned to you now and like to hear your thoughts on interoperability. We know the DOD and the VA have a huge challenge ahead of them as they integrate their electronic health record systems. So what is, in your opinion, what is the current state of EHR interoperability and what barriers exist to improvement?
Good. Well, first of all, thank you, Susan, and thank you, Booz Allen, for including me on your panel today. I'm delighted to be here. Let me answer your question by establishing a framework of the answer, and then let me try to fill in that framework with some specifics. I think in the federal space specifically, but really in the private sector generally, you're seeing a transition away from systems that are proprietary, closed, and customized. Right? Proprietary, closed, custom systems are expensive. We have lulled ourselves into believing that they're more secure. They're not. And it's very, very difficult to maintain and extend those systems. We spend a lot of time in the government actually fixing things that are obsolete as opposed to investing in things that could actually move us further along the quality, safety, and cost curve. Instead, what you're seeing, and I think you've seen this very explicitly and very loudly inside the VA-DOD collaboration, of course, but also in the private sector, we're moving now to a world where systems are standards-based, they're openly architected, and they're modular. Standards-based, openly architected, and modular systems are more cost-effective, they're safer, and we believe that they're actually going to lead to better outcomes. What we do know today for sure is that they're safer. We do know today for sure that they cost less. What we don't yet have evidence of, just because we're just thinking about how to collect it in a sensible and structured way, what we don't have yet evidence of is what really are the quality outcomes. Do we know that we're extending life looking at these systems? I think everybody here believes that we do. I certainly do. But we don't have the evidence of that yet. But I would already have two good reasons, safety and cost, to keep moving forward. I'd be happy to talk more about this if you like, or should we go on to the next?
Nope, we'll go on to the next one. How about that? So, but thank you. Sure. And Ted, I'd like to turn to you. We all love your Kaiser Permanente commercials, but what we really want to know about is your EHR and the EHR quality in recent years, and what successes have you really experienced at Kaiser Permanente?
Sure. Well, thanks for loving us. So we finished our electronic health record implementation in 2010, which impacts about 450 medical offices, 36 hospitals, 16,000 physicians, 43,000 nurses. So to add to everyone's points, what we're really passionate about is what we can do for our members. And now there are 9 million of them, 250,000 new in 2011. And I want to just give two examples. One is prevention and one is treatment. So prevention, prior to the electronic health record, these, as people are saying, these were fixed systems. And now what we are doing is we are expanding what we can do with them. So exercise is a vital sign. So now when you go see a doctor, it's blood pressure, weight, temperature, pulse. How many minutes a week do you exercise? Which was unheard of before. When you would say to a doctor, is exercise a vital sign? They'd say, what? And now on our social network, there's actually conversations about, well, how do we define exercise? What do we do when the answer is zero, which sometimes it is? And it's really getting us to the point we've always wanted to be. On treatment, so HIV, we do have good outcomes. So it was just announced January 26th that we have successfully eliminated disparities in HIV treatment. So in the United States, if you're a Black American, you're 15% more likely to die if you have HIV. At Kaiser Permanente, that is no longer the case. Nationally, the rate of suppression of HIV virus is 19%, Kaiser Permanente 68%. And that is almost, that is in large part to the EHR and to the leadership. So it's both things.
That's great. Thank you, Ted. We're going to turn to our second topic, which is meaningful use's role in incentivizing adoption and impeding innovation. So a little bit of a dicey topic, I guess. The federal government's meaningful use program enacted in 2009 created incentives for widespread EHR implementation, establishes criteria for evaluating whether EHRs improve healthcare quality, and outlines a framework for measuring how EHRs are used. Meaningful use can be a divisive topic in healthcare and in health IT circles, with some praising its role in increasing adoption and others citing dissatisfaction with meaningful use criteria. Some experts even believe that meaningful use has inadvertently hampered innovation. So let's talk about perspectives on what meaningful use has meant to the EHR landscape. I'm going to start with you, Gordon. From your perspective as a practitioner, can you talk about some of the effects of meaningful use that you have seen?
The benefit of electronic records is still mostly a promise in most practices. There are a lot of clinicians I speak to around the country and I interact with on listservs who see or believe that they can accomplish what they need with paper charts. And I don't quite buy that when you start thinking about population health and quality improvement. But it was an uphill struggle talking with them about transition to EHR before meaningful use criteria, and frankly, the dollars, the money is what turned their head. Meaningful use criteria are just the means to the money for them, and they're looking for a way to finance the purchase or subsidize the purchase. And now the conversation is around, how do we meet those criteria and get the right EHR and get my check?
Ted, how about you? Based on your experience, what are the most important things to focus on moving forward?
Well, I have a specific interest, and I think is shared by my physician colleagues in patient access of the EHR. So we have 9 million members, 3.8 million of them are signed up for a personal health record. We are now getting more than a million email messages to our doctors every month. And also what's interesting is our physicians are sending out, our providers, 450,000 messages a month as well. So it's not just reactive, it's proactive. Their family members are accessing it on their behalf, parents on behalf of children. So we want to see more of that, more usability for the patient, because they're the ones who this impacts in the end.
Great. So Dr. Bosch, now we're going to turn to you. We are in the midst of this multi-year drive for the Meaningful Use Incentive Program to spur the adoption of EHRs for doctors and hospitals. One, do you think it will ultimately be a success? And two, what to you actually defines that success?
Sure. So I'll do something that's unusual in Washington, which is directly answer your question. I'll start by saying
provocative.
Yes, I do think it will be a success because it already has been successful. Let me, before I expound on that, take one moment to do what I was sitting on my hands so I wouldn't do before, which was applaud for Ted and what you presented in terms of Kaiser's accomplishment. You know, to talk about reduction in disparities, let's see if we can reduce them by 1% or 5%. I didn't hear that from his lips. I heard eliminate. A lot of people would think the ability to eliminate the disparity was theoretical, and I think what was shown at Kaiser, I would say, and no offense to my colleagues at Kaiser, can be done by others, must be done by others, but using a model of health IT enabled process change and focus. To Gordon's point of what, you know, have we seen and what will we see, it's not just the technology. We can put a computer in front of someone, and if someone's purpose is to, I want to move from 30 patients a day to 35 patients a day, and I don't care about anything else, no surprise, quality studies on someone operating in that environment will show no improvement in quality. You really need to see focus, payment, dedication, and the supporting technology. So what's already been successful? Well, my first answer was evolution of EHRs, what they used to look like. They don't look like that anymore. There is not an EHR in the market in the United States that doesn't at least have the beginnings of a quality dashboard, the ability to look at things that people in systems such as Kaiser have been doing for years, a concept that was foreign in private practice. What's a patient panel? What's a patient population? What do you mean all of my patients with diabetes? What is that? Well, now that's easy to, it's required. It's part of certification. Another thing that I think looks different is that even the conversation is different. 5 years ago, if I would be in a policy a meeting with talking about technology, the focus was always on the technology. if we only put computers on desktops or mobile, you know, devices in the hands of providers, everything would improve. And it was, well, no, it wouldn't. You know, what are you thinking? It's the device plus what the device can do plus how it's used. So if you say, oh, device, what it is, what it looks like, how it's used, that's kind of the overarching principles of the meaningful use program. Now, to get to your point about commenting, you know, if we talk a month from now, yeah, I will be deep myself into responding into the minutiae of stage two of meaningful use, and yeah, doctors are really good, myself as a prime example, in looking for minutiae and commenting on commas and periods and exclamation points that shouldn't be there and moved. I know that's important, but in terms of the overarching improvement, I think it will be. Last point, a study came out, I believe it was yesterday, from Accenture that shocked me. As of perhaps it was last month, the percent of physicians in the United States using EHRs, using health IT, doing e-prescribing, connecting with their patients is now the highest in the world. I have to change all my slides. All my slides comparing us to industrialized countries showed the U.S. at the bottom. So if we did nothing else, look at what we've done in 18 months.
Yeah, some really good successes. Peter Levin, since the VA is not eligible for meaningful use incentive payments, given your government, the growth you have seen in the past few years is not spurred by the same motivators experienced in the private sector. Why don't you talk a little bit about innovation at VA, and in particular, the Blue Button program, which I know you're very proud of.
Oh, thank you very much. My pleasure. To talk about the role of innovation at the VA, you have to really start with the most recent program, which is something the Secretary has led called VAI2, VA Innovation Initiative. Of course, we at the VA are very proud. We kind of think we invented the EHR, right? If you look at where Vista is today and the trends that it has set, the standard that it has calibrated, and what we are actually doing inside the VA to extend its capabilities, and the interoperability question that we discussed earlier, bringing the Vista connected to the DoD programs, in fact, connecting it through the NHIN work to the outside world. This is something that we're enormously proud of. So let me talk for a couple seconds about the process of innovation at the VA. Of course, VAI2, which is run by my friend and colleague Jonah Zerwinski, is not the only program, but it is the only structured program inside our 300,000-person agency. So the first thing that we did was we asked our employees. We have over 300,000 of them. We thought they may have an idea or two of how we can deliver higher quality services. How can we reduce costs? How can we keep better track of our veterans? You're right. We don't have the necessarily. We always have cost considerations, but it's a taxpayer cost consideration.
Right.
We have a morally transcendent mission. It's almost as good.
Yeah.
We take care of veterans, right? So we asked our employees what we thought that they should do, and we're looking for concrete outcomes. Things like improving access, of course, lowering costs, increasing quality, and really opening the aperture of innovation in a way that, frankly, they didn't have access to in the past. Blue Button grew out of that conversation. For those of you who don't know, Blue Button is a personal health record. It's a subset. It's a piece of the kind of clinical information that you would have in an EHR, but it's really what you know about yourself. When you go to a clinical encounter and the clipboard you fill out, who are you? Why are you here? Where do you live? What's your insurance information? This kind of information now can be captured also electronically. Frankly, it's pretty easy. And we've extended it at the VA to include other clinical information, things like laboratory results, wellness reminders, and medical appointments. Blue Button has become very, very popular. 750,000 of our countrymen are using it today. Aetna and United Health have adopted the Blue Button platform. The Office of Personnel Management has asked all carriers, all federal health insurers, to adopt the Blue Button platform. And there are a lot of now small and large companies like Microsoft that can read the format, because we know that Peter is probably a guy's name. We know that Silver Spring is probably a place. We know that penicillin is a medicine, even if it's not spelled correctly, and we know that sore throat is probably an indication. So what I'm trying to convey is the simplicity of the idea and the ability that we can create an electronic record, an electronic personal health record, that is both simultaneously readable by people who are not doctors and by machines who know how to interpret it. So it's been a very successful program for us, and we are indeed quite proud of it.
Yeah, and I, you know, I think a real credit to your leadership, Peter. I know it wouldn't have gotten off the ground without your passion around it, so thank you. So we're going to shift gears to our topic number three, which is what to expect of EHRs in the next 5 to 10 years. So let's talk a little bit about what we can expect from the standpoint of innovation. Another aspect to consider is the federal government's role in adoption we've seen to date. But a presidential election is coming up in a few months, as we all know, and the next administration may or may not play a leading role in EHR adoption, innovation, and security. So let's discuss what this future state might look like with or without government intervention. So from our policy wonk over here, we're going to turn to Peter Bosch. You like that name I gave you? You've done a lot of work with MedStar in overseeing the implementation of their ambulatory EHR system. What do you think the HIT ecosystem will look like in 10 years? And what do we need to do to plan for its success?
Sure. So let me start that one with let's not overplay technology innovation without thinking about the entire space or ecosystem, as your question included. One of the things I did about 12 years ago as one of my first leadership roles was work with a IT startup, which I won't name, which was building a patient access tool. And we built out these algorithms for patient portals to allow patients to actually have e-visits, or I think we called them web visits back then. And as soon as we built it, and I'm not a coder. I did the idea work and how it could work and be brought into the physician. I said, that's great. Now I want you to turn it off for my health system, because nobody will use this until we change the payment model and begin to tell docs, this is real work. This isn't what you do after your 10 or 12 hours a day in the office and you do every night and every weekend. That is not a sustainable system. So getting to your question of what will the technology looks like, I'll get back to what I said before, and this really is a statement that could be made to whomever wins the election and whatever their political philosophy is that the healthcare system that we have and how we pay for that healthcare will determine what we see. I mean, the good and the bad about this great country of ours is that market force will tell our private innovators, the market, you know, here's what people will buy. Here's what will be useful. So, for example, if we have a health system that says, here's a pot of money, however you want to call it, ACO model, accountable care organization, or capitation, you know, I know I'm not supposed to use that word anymore, but something that looks more like that, and how can you use your IT systems to do better with less? You will do obvious things. How can I bring in data sources from wherever so that I can reduce unnecessary duplication, because not only is it wasteful, it hurts my bottom line. How could I turn on what Peter helped to build, and many other people have done a far better job than I did, in terms of e-visit logic, such that we can use it where appropriate, because in fact, I should stop saying nice things about Kaiser.
But you know, they've done
Okay.
You can compliment the VA too.
I'm serious. They've done great work with this. It fits their business model, but I could also say some unflattering things about how I would do things differently, such that I'd frame the question differently. How could you, in this model where payment is off the table and you want to do the very best with the least cost at the least inconvenience for the patient? Remember, even those of us who are providers are patients. We have family members who are patients. And to take a family member or oneself to a doctor can be at least a half a day off of work. And what if the only reason you're going there is to say, look at a list of my blood sugars, or here are my weights and my blood pressures? What a waste of everybody's time. So to be able to not just allow for that to happen, but encourage it to happen, to proact with people and say the best model is you, the patient, need to understand your disease. You need to know all of the clinical indicators and quality measures better than I do, because I'll forget, and that you are activated and engaged and proacted by the system, reminding, I haven't seen your sugars in a couple of weeks, send them in. Wouldn't that be the right way to do it? So what would we see in that kind of a payment system? I think someone else introduced the term first, so I'm allowed to say it. Way cool. Some way cool things that are technologically possible now. Quality, safety, cost or value dashboards, patient experience dashboards, all sorts of things that actually help to align how we practice care such that it is a higher quality experience, better care, safer care, more affordable care. Now that you've introduced it, I'll say it, no disparities, not less, no disparities care. We need to push for this, and something that patients experience as valuable.
Thank you. So Gordon, a question about current EHR adoption and the role that the government has played. And then, you know, for the future, what role should the government play? And I want to ask you a follow-on question, you know, around, you know, analytics. Now that we have the data, you know, what do we do with it beyond what Peter has already talked about? What are the other things that we can think about for the future from the analytics perspective?
Yeah. The adoption curve has been a big boon, and I think that's a great thing that the government has done. The specificity about the elements of functionality, I think, can be a constraint, actually a problem. If you get really granular in policy and start telling me how I have to write stuff down, I'm probably going to spend more time than I need to following arcane minutiae and regulation, and that's not helpful, to be very blunt. And so I hope for less of that, but let's step back, not dive into the minutiae as we do so often in healthcare, and let's start looking at the big picture. Is it more important in my practice to check the microalbumin of an individual with diabetes or to look at the aggregate experience of patients in my practice vis-a-vis ease of access, ability to communicate effectively, whether or not I waste people's time? If you look at the total impact on the population health of those that I serve, the latter has much greater import than the former. Neither are unimportant, but there is a relative difference in importance. And what I find frustrating is the level of detail in some of the regulation sets that hit practices like mine that start to dictate very small behaviors. It's like, you know, back off. Let's look at the big picture here. What are we trying to accomplish? We're trying to look at total cost of care, bend the cost curve so we start looking like OECD countries. Let's talk about overall patient experience of care and quality, and let's get these conversations on the same table. The problem right now is that the finance guys and the quality guys in most health plans seem to operate in different universes, and we need to get everybody in the same room and talk about how electronics and information technology facilitate that conversation. There's a wonderful overlap. Right now, the perception in the country is that we have large bodies that accredit quality measures and that seem to have little, if any, impact on total cost, and that's not right because we know that there is an impact when we get that stuff right. So let's get the quality and finance people together. Let's talk about how total cost of care is a legitimate metric that we can look at all the way down to the individual PCP level as a fiduciary responsibility that I have, and let's talk about how information technology can support that. Then the problem comes on tracking stuff so that we can understand quality, both for accountability, but also to assist those in practice as they're looking for opportunities to improve. Technology can play a huge role there if we can figure out how to aggregate data. One of the problems that I have as an independent clinician and looking at others in similar roles is that the numbers that we track in our practice are insufficient to be statistically meaningful, and therefore analysis on arcane minutiae of clinical reasoning fall apart. And my quality indicators are say, well, we can't really tell because the numbers are so small, so we'll just attribute you to the mean. That's meaningless. You've lost me at that point. Let's figure other measure sets that have large denominator. Let's also aggregate data across practices. One thing I like about big systems is the ability to aggregate data, and yet at the same time, I don't like the idea of, like, you know, monolithic health systems taking over the world. I think there ought to be choice. There ought to be options. People like that. I do too. But we can bridge this with payment, with appropriate policy around quality measurement and the right IT.
Thank you. So Peter Levin, we're going to warm you up for your cyber chat this afternoon. Okay. So based on your experience at the VA, how should healthcare professionals embrace next-gen technologies while balancing the need for privacy and security?
Good. So thanks very much for the question. Privacy is often a reason why people don't do new things, right? And this is especially true in medicine and in clinical care. And part of that is legitimate. Not all of it's legitimate. Part of that is legitimate. As we're moving, you know, sort of to this new model of care where it's really patient-centered, and by patient-centered we mean we really want to have authentic dialogue with our clinical care provider, we're opening up a sort of a new vista, really, in the privacy of that conversation, the privacy that is mediated through electronic means. So we at VA, of course, take privacy, I would say, is the transcendent design criteria of everything we do, and we've had a breach. Right, so that tends to focus the mind. So to the extent that we were able to move the culture forward and say we need to start thinking more carefully about electronic records and about interoperability, then all of a sudden a few years ago, somebody leaves a laptop in the wrong place, it's out in the wild, and we got it back, and in fact, no patient records were lost, but man, that was a hectic couple of days, right?
Yeah.
So the problem is, of course, that there's no window to go to for your privacy. So let me please try a brief thought experiment with the people in the room. If you are the richest person in the room, if you are the person, and you know this for sure, who has the most money, if you could do me the personal favor of just raising your hand, letting me know, because what I'd like to do is get your money. It'll cost me, I'm guessing, around $10,000. It might be $100,000. It'll take me, I'm guessing, a week. It might actually take me a month. But I can tell you this for sure and for certain, I am a cybersecurity expert. I will, in fact, empty your bank account. That's a pain for you. It's good for me. And all the rest of you, don't worry. This isn't a conversation that you need to listen to carefully, except for this part. If I was going after your records, if I was going after your patient records, you might have something to say about that. You might actually really be really concerned because there is no window to go to get your privacy back. So what we've done really, I would say culturally, and we're kind of wrapping our minds around this in a more constructive way now, we're learning what we mean when we say beware of the scalable breach, right? Beware of cybersecurity holes, cybersecurity vulnerabilities that allow a black-headed person, right? Somebody who wants to get into your into an arbitrary person's record and get as many of them as they can, take it back home, look at it, figure out who's famous, who's important, who's politically vulnerable, who's trying to get a job, and start, doing nefarious things, right? But it's an arbitrary attack as opposed to a specific attack. It's the arbitrary attacks that you have to worry about. If we get over the fact that we're never going to have perfect security, it isn't going to happen, and we get over the fact that we can spend trillions of dollars trying to achieve that next layer of stability, but there is a real opportunity cost because then we're not doing all the other things that we're describing on the panel today, making healthcare better, doing more fundamental research, creating interoperable records. So the tools are there. We know how to do this in a better way now. What we're really looking at, certainly inside of the VA, I think generally across government, is truly a cultural shift, moving away from not a single person can lose their records or else, which is, by the way, bad. I'm not trying to advocate that as a sufficient solution. But if we can sort of abstract the problem a little bit and say, well, what are we doing at a systematic level? What are we doing at an enterprise and institutional level to make sure that we're detecting those nefarious agents who are constantly trying to get into our network and just see what they can get out?
Thank you. Ted, we're going to shift gears a little bit. I'm going to congratulate you again, one for your great commercials, but you're also recognized as a leader in health IT. And we want to talk a little bit about future technologies like mobile applications. How will we use our iPads, iPhones, et cetera, in the future as it relates to healthcare? And is Kaiser testing anything today?
Yes. Everyone get out your mobile phones, get on your browsers, go to kp.org, and this is now live. So as of January 24th, 9 million members can access their medical records from their mobile. All platforms are welcome. You don't need to download an app. You can email your doctor. You can get your lab test results. You can book an appointment with the time that you want. You can refill medications, or medications are coming. Oh, actually, no, you can refill medications. So we're there. And just like Peter was saying, one of our most valuable assets is our members' time. And it's not just their time. It's their employer's time. It's their family's time. It's their community's time. So the more time they spend wherever they are being healthy, and the less time they spend coming to us when they would rather be somewhere else, it's better for all of us. So that when they do come to us, it's for a reason where we can help sit down and talk with them, maybe have longer visits with them in the future, because all the other stuff is in another space where it's more reasonable for them. And this works from anywhere in the world. So this has been a dream of ours for a really long time. And we clearly believe the future is more access rather than less to the EHR.
That's great. So we're all excited we're going to get on KP.org. I know that you all have done some things too, and I'm a little off the script because we have a little bit of time left, Peter. At the VA, you're testing some things around iPads and iPhones, I think.
We are. So
thank you.
I'll eventually get this right. Clearly there's... let me start with the bad news, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, somehow, and this always happens in government, it certainly happens to the VA, you know, for all I know, we were the last persons to get telephones and fax machines or refillable ink pens, right? You know, there's this notion where the public sector is inevitably behind the curve, not just because we need to be safer or more secure, but because it just takes so darn long to get through. And guess what? We sort of got that when it came to these mobile electronic devices. It ended up that, in fact, there were legitimate, important concerns about privacy, right? So when I say beware of the scalable breach, there were well-known holes. There were things that we could negotiate about and help improve with the various vendors to make sure that when we did start adopting them, which, by the way, is an extraordinarily important and useful thing, when we did start adopting them, we could have a higher level of assuredness, higher level of certainty that somebody eavesdropping on that conversation wasn't going to actually be able to pick off not just any record, but a particular record. Fast forward to today, I forget exactly the number, but it's I think hundreds of thousands, right? I mean, whatever it is, it's a big number, and we're now starting to do what for me is the really interesting work is, so how actually are you going to use this device, you know?
Yeah.
So we also have web-enabled services inside of our electronic health record. And we're looking, you know, we're watching the doctors watching the patients. By the way, the word from a patient to all my doctors on the panel and to those listening is, you know, look up sometimes, right? You know, let's use this as a collaboration tool in this new patient-centered model of care. And we at the VA, I think, really are on the vanguard of actually creating the user interface, creating the environment, creating the framework in which we can have a very sensible dialogue. So we're very much at the beginning. I actually don't even know yet how many have been deployed, but this is a very big deal inside of the institution right now. We're very excited about it.
And Gordon, off script for you too. Just, I know that you had some concerns about, you know, where the data might go and who it should be protected from. Do you want to comment on your perspective on privacy and security?
Yeah, I mean, I just get a little bit creepy when I think about the Patriot Act and health information technology. You know, we're aggregating all this stuff. We know a heck of a lot about a heck of a lot of people. And yeah, I just hope that there are some very serious firewalls. We can say no, unless you meet some extraordinary criteria and go through some extraordinary judicial process. No, you can't have access to this information.
Thank you. We're moving toward the end of today's discussion, and we've heard a number of diverse perspectives from our illustrious panel exploring the evolution of electronic health records to date and what we can look forward into the future. So to help summarize for our listeners out here in the audience and also out in the internet land, we would like to quickly hear a response to a closing question. And that question is, what is the biggest game changer for electronic health records? So why don't we start down here with Dr. Bosch?
Thank you. So I will say again what I've said before, that to me the biggest game changer is get the healthcare system and payment right. Get those aligned, and if we get those aligned, the health IT will follow, whether it's mobile devices, huge screens in the room, pre-visit questionnaires, forgetting the idea that doctors need to remember all of the dashboards and rules and clinical measures, the activated patient will now do it. If we get the system right and the payment right, the rest will follow. The cautionary tone, because I've heard this many times, and you know, your last question on way cool things and devices, I was gonna, you know, do my profit thing here. Wait a second, let's not forget that devices are cool, but devices used outside of a system in which they will lead to better care may just be cool devices without good things. So let's get the system right, let's get payment right, the rest will follow.
Okay, great. Ted, we're gonna take it to you. You've done great things in health IT, you've gone mobile. What else are we gonna do?
The game changer is the patient. So the era of the patient is finally here. All of us that went to medical school wanted to do great things for patient, and we've been shackled by the lack of technology or the ability to be there for them, or we wanted to be in a sane, workflow-neutral way. Now that's gone. So now we are showing excellent results, as all of everyone else here will or has already, in terms of what our members and patients sees the value of technology for them. And that's where it matters. When they leave a Kaiser Permanente region to go somewhere else and say, where's my EHR? Where's my access? That's a win for us. And we're going to see more in that from all of your systems as well.
That's great. Peter, I know you've been known as the innovator at the VA, and they put you on the toughest problems that the VA has. So what's the game changer in your mind?
Well, thank you for the kind words. For me, the game changer is really about interoperability. And from a patient perspective, that means continuity of care. And we've talked about that a lot, I think, in the last 45 minutes, where these isolated stovepipes, false or improperly structured incentives, and paper-bound systems are coming together now, I think, in a constructive way, in a useful way, in a way that the country can afford, in a way that I think is ultimately going to benefit patients. But sometimes, again, from a patient perspective and from the VA, the conversation about healthcare reform was justifiably about payer reform, but healthcare reform, to quote a favorite mentor of mine, healthcare reform is supposed to be and will be about better health. And so as we bring these systems together, the superior continuity of care that's enabled by the integrated health records, I think, is going to be the real game changer.
Great. And Gordon, last but not least, what's your game changer?
I'm going off of what Peter Levin said. I think interoperability is the thing. I think it's more than just that. It's the ability to break out of these silos. Much as I love Kaiser, the idea that when I leave their system, I no longer have access? No. That's got to change. It should be portable. We should be able to have that kind of system anywhere we go. So I see an opportunity in information technology to be able to bridge the silos between the systems and to work for the healthcare consumer and to make their records truly portable with them and accessible any setting where they give permission to the providers to access the information.
You definitely need a blue button.
I would just want to say we are actively working. We are involved in all the major efforts to standardize movement of information. So. It's not a silo. We're an integrated care system, and we know people move around. Just to say that.
Okay. All right. We're not going to beat each other. We're not going to beat each other up here. We're going to hold hands as soon as this is over. Okay. So we're going to go ahead and wrap up now. I'd like to thank our distinguished panelists for their contributions to this very interesting discussion. Today's Expert Voices panel, Electronic Health Records 2.0, What Does the Future Hold?, featured Peter Bosch, Medical Director for Ambulatory EHR and Health IT Policy at MedStar Health, Teddy Tan, Director at Kaiser Permanente within the Federation, Peter Levin, Senior Advisor to the Secretary and Chief Technology Office, Veterans Administration, and L. Gordon Moore, President of Ideal Medical Practices and Director of Clinical Transformation for Treo Solutions. The Expert Voices panel was brought to you by Booz Allen Hamilton and Federal News Radio. I encourage you to listen to this panel on demand, watch video from the panel, and read expert commentary on the topic at www.boozallen.com/expertvoices. This is Susan Penfield, Senior Vice President at Booz Allen Hamilton. Thank you for listening. Thank you.